Blog Talk Radio.
Sophisticated gorillas. Hey man, I need a better car. I need a better crib. I need better insurance for me and my kids. I need a better job, cause I need better pay. It's gonna take better bread for me to make a better way. I need better water to flow through my faucet. I dress to impress, so I need a better closet. I love my family and love my friends, but the haters get you paper, so I need more of them. I don't do it for the fame, but in this rap game, man, being popular is like the only way to win. So my hooks are powerful with dope ass lyrics. Man, all I need now is for the whole world to hear it. Rappers be hating, though. Everyone's a critic and scared to admit it, that deep down they fear it. My boys in the streets say I need better promotion, but when the pastor preaches, say I need better devotion. Man, I just wanna sail every ocean, rock a couple boats and create some locomotion. Man, I just wanna fly to Philly skies, sipping on sake till I get the Japanese eyes, man. Cause I'm all about my business, man. Yeah, I think I need a better business plan. Nowadays, you can catch me in a suit and tie. Don't get it twisted, fly, die, still ride or die. We can take it to the streets. We can take it back to wearing black boots with fatigues. Whoa. Cause I always been a soldier. I'm in it to win it. No limit, boy. I thought I told ya.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought I told ya.
Okay.
Sophisticated
COD.
Come on.
Going through it, sort of like an ongoing movement. And my moms knew it, she tried to read me songs through it. In and out of jail, no bail, my bond's stupid. Can't explain the pain, so I write a song through it. They say the streets talk, real niggas respond to it. You can tell by how I walk, got a bond with the music. Where your mind at? Find time to lose it. My paradigm designed to shine, I'm translucent. The proof is, gotta decipher what the truth is. And you see it through that thug eyes, it's ruthless. And you see it through the fiend mouth, it's toothless. Won't you tell me, can you really see the truth? Yeah. They brain feed us, they can't reach us, them lame teachers. They wanna be us, the first lady was named Jesus. The game need us, I bang heaters, they can't see us. Plus I promise God to spread love till the pain leaves us. Yeah, I hold it down, but my cheese up. What? I'm from the ground, I build my G's up. Yup, cause this is peace, put the peace up. Plus I'm trying to eat, we can feast, put your feet up. You weak as fuck, if you sleeping, get up. Teachers corrupt, plus the preachers still compete for a buck. And if you speaking too much, you get easy. Cause when I let the chopper go, look like I'm beefing it up. I can't lose if I'm winning, with the 22 spinning. You see the crew sitting, come through with the roof missing. The truth is I'm sinning, rocking the true religion. New blueprint vision in a blue suit killing.
Yeah,
and I'm killing them.
Such a glorious event. Let's go. Una vida mayor, una vida mayor. The good energy over here, we living better than y'all. I wake up and do what I love up on this spiritual course. Running circles around you fuckers, got y'all niggas exhausted. Nah, it ain't luck, homie, blame it on the cuss. Plus the flow like titanium, baby, ain't never rust. Now you find me in the cut, most of vices, I gave them up. Now when I step up on the scene, most demons, they run them up. So bitch, you better duck, not even laws are enough to place a nigga in the trance and try to call that shit love. Don't be a dud, step fire if you search for that buzz. Try to then conquer that, so I already know what it was. But yo, I'm not one to judge like you catch a charge. Cause I'm the enemy of the state and the sector is large, get it? A lot of haters won't admit it, live gifted. I could tell by my son's shoe size that time is ticking. A few spies speak true lies about my mission. Zero dark 30 accomplishment, how you living? Because I live and let it be, my motto's longevity. I'm all mine, so I ain't hearing what you said to me. When y'all rhyming, y'all having difficulty. Technically I'm hot, crack the clock pot with this verbal recipe. Such a secret how your boy stacking paper off this underground flow like slave statues in Grenada. Hooray for us to better living. Nigga, did you vote or what? Now fuck the system, when I depart I bet they miss him. Gone, but back again, I'm dying a better death to live long, I admit it.
The one thing that we could say about African peoples is that we left evidence of ourselves all over this planet. And that's the problem with European scientists. The deeper they dig, the blacker the planet gets. And what we have been made to see now is this infusion of European, philosophies about what the past was, and no one else on TV is actually giving us evidence of what we were, who we were, but Europeans.
Every person has the right to know their ancestral history. Every person, no matter where they are in the world.
Most of world history, 90% of world history is African history. And even that 10% Africa was extraordinarily involved in making it what it is.
You won't find a painting, you won't find a statue, you won't find a monument anywhere prior to 1500 that isn't Africoid in some way, shape, or form.
Black folk don't have a problem. White folk got a problem. Black folk problem is that white folk got a problem. The real problem we have is white supremacy. The real problem we have is the perception people have of us.
From 1790 up until 1965, your immigration laws played almost zero for black folk. You had a zero immigration law for black folk. Because you're destined to be a planned minority. You know what a minority means? That means a loser. That means you're a loser.
It's very difficult to control a group of people militarily because eventually the money will run out if you try to control a group of people militarily. And also the possibility of them raising up against you is always imminent. So it's best to control a people psychologically.
When you conquer a people, you have two choices. One, you have to commit an act of genocide. Either you wipe them out completely, complete act of genocide so that you can take over the resources in the land. Or you kill the warrior class of these people and you enslave the children and the elderly. This is just war history. In our situation, meaning those that live in the United States, the choice was enslavement, not genocide. That means that from a child, you have to be taught that everything about you is wrong. Everything about who you were and where you came from is wrong. And I mean wrong, immoral and illegal.
Melanin is a neurochemical that is produced in part through the pituitary and the pineal gland. They both play a central role in the production of melanin, which is ultimately responsible for the color that we have in our skin. Now, historically, it had always been thought that melanin played a significant role in the intellectual propensity of African people. For example, when you study some of the Greek writings on melanin, or the color of Africans, many of the Greek philosophers believed that that melanin played some sort of a role in how Africans had been able to create and develop some of the sciences that they had come to be known for. So melanin was always considered an intellectual sort of a chemical.
The pineal gland, which produces melanin, it's shaped like a pine cone. And the origin of the word pineal literally means resembling a pine cone. Now, in ancient symbolism, the pine cone has always been represented because people knew the importance of the pineal gland as it related to melanin and the universe.
Melanin is a molecule. And the concept of melanin is it is black in its nature. And we find it in the cosmos. We find it in the heavens. We find it in water, we find it in land, we find it in everything that exists.
The sperm of the male and the egg of the woman, they're both layered with melanin. So that when the sperm penetrates the egg, there is a melanin explosion. And that melanin helps to formulate the fetus within that egg, and that fetus is literally coated with the melanin substance. And that melanin substance then goes on to form the brain and the central nervous system. So every human being begins with a melanin explosion.
Melanin is an intelligence. It's an intelligence because it is the dynamic, the primary dynamic in every part of the cell. It's a primary dynamic in the core of the human being as well as to the surface of the human being. Its intelligence is responsible for the forming of the nervous system. Every part of the nervous system has these little black dots all through it, which essentially carry information.
So melanin, from a physical standpoint, is that substance that accounts for what black people refer to as soul. We move differently, we walk differently, we talk differently, because we have access to a different form of energy than other folk.
Not only is melanin a pigment, which is so obvious, but melanin as an intelligence is a communications module that essentially broadcasts as well as receives information by way of light and sound frequency signatures.
Scholars and scientists have been having conferences about melanin, to my awareness, at least since the 1920s.
The pineal glands of most of our white brothers and sisters are calcified, and so they make less melanin. And that comes from the historical relationship to what we call the Wormian Ice Age, that 10,000 years of glacial freezing that happened in Europe after the Africans who were the Grimaldi moved up there. And so it became the survival of the fittest. Who was able to adapt could survive. Who wasn't able to adapt died. So those people who were able to get rid of their melanin was able to survive. Those who could not get rid of the melanin, they died.
These scientists said that the pineal gland, they refer to the pineal gland as a vestigial organ. That is a calcified gland within the body that served no purpose. As if the creator would create something that you didn't need. And it was only after the Vietnam War, in the late 60s and early 70s, that they began to rewrite their interpretation of the pineal gland. The reason for that was that a large number of African Americans fought and died during the Vietnam War. And whenever a soldier dies, there's an autopsy that's performed before their body is sent back to Dover Air Force Base. And what they discovered, what these physicians discovered, is that when they performed the autopsies, the 75 to 80% of the African-American soldiers had a large functioning pineal gland. A pineal gland is normally about the size of your thumb. So it was not a vestigial organ in 70 to 80% of African-Americans, but it is a calcified organ in 75 to 80% of people with European ancestry. So they began to reevaluate the pineal gland. They began to reevaluate melanin.
I think if you talk to Dr. Welsing, she'll tell you this is about genetic annihilation or genetic survival, okay? It's about genetics. Who will survive America? Who will survive the world? Whose genetics will hold up? What is going to be the genotype that's on the planet 1,000 years from now? Will it be white? Will it be brown? Will it be black? And so you find that the elements of the human family that find themselves suffering from the ecology that we're in, they're struggling to survive and to be able to maintain themselves. All nations, European nations and America, white Americans, are at minus birth rate right now. Not zero birth rate, where they're keeping up with the natural death. They're at minus birth rate. And so that's why there's so much emphasis on artificial birth creation and other ways to have babies and make babies that are beyond the normal. And you'll also find that this adopting black babies, the Haiti thing, getting the children out of Central African Republic and Chad, adopting Filipino babies, Latino babies by the white community on such a high level, it is to reinfuse their gene pool with the melanin.
A few years ago, the president of Chad, a man by the name of Idriss Deby, he had a group of French charity workers arrested after it was found out that they were kidnapping children from that area. Now, Debbie accused them of stealing the children from their parents and planning to sell the children to pedophile rings up in Europe. He also accused them of possibly planning to kill the children to sell their organs. Now, this is the president of Chad saying this, and this was a big scandal with the Chadian government and the French government. So we need to understand everything that's going on with people going into Africa trying to get these children up out of here. There's a war being waged on melanated people, and melanated people, people of color, should realize that a war is going on. A lot of melanated people do not realize that this war is going on, and this war is going on an educational front. There's a spiritual warfare. There's a medical warfare. There's a prison industrial warfare, and there's an economic warfare being imposed on people of color, especially in America. If you want to convince a group of people that everything about them is negative, what you have to do is tell them where they're from is a negative place, and this is what they've done to black people. They say, black people, you're negative, you're bad, because Africa is negative, and Africa is bad. So the images that we have of Africa, we always see the underbelly. We always see the propaganda. We always see the warfare, but they never show the other side.
One of the things that I've discovered about conquered people is that most conquered people have had their ancestral memory erased, and they only know what missionaries or enslavers have taught them. And usually it's negative.
There is good, there is bad, there is advancement, and there is a lack of advancement in all cultures. The problem is that this society tends to want to show you the extended belly of a baby in Ethiopia. It wants to show you the negativity of Africa.
People think Africa and Asia and Guatemala, Southern America, these places are all jungle. Jungle came after the invasions of European colonialism. Then the jungles came in because nobody was manning the land anymore.
Look at the map. Just this map tells you alone that the great majority of Africa is grassland. It shows you right here. It's grassland. No jungle. In fact, the Everglades, by proportion, there's more jungle in the Everglades than there is proportionately in Africa. And that's in Florida.
There's more jungle in Europe and in Asia than there is in Africa. Without a doubt, Africa has its wetlands, it has its greenery, some of the most beautiful animal and animal kingdoms in the world. But most of Africa is not jungle. There's more jungle on the other continents than there is in Africa. In fact, you have vast greenlands in Africa, miles, tens of thousands of miles of nothing but flat, beautiful green land.
Whenever they show images of Africa, they like to show the hunter-gatherers, the bushmen, the brothers running around half-naked with sticks. And that really represents about 1% of the whole population of Africa. As a matter of fact, you have those same hunter-gatherer people up in Europe. There's a group of people called the Sami people who live just like that, who live in mud huts, and they live that hunter-gatherer experience. But you never see any kind of mention of them in the media. You only see the African bushmen, but you never see the rest of the whole continent and see how people are really living over there. Whenever you look at old Tarzan movies, old cartoons from back in the 1920s and 30s, they would always show the cannibalistic African person dancing around in the jungle with a big pot, putting in missionaries, cooking them and eating them. And that's a major myth about Africa, because there's no evidence of any kind of cannibalism going on in Africa.
There is no evidence of cannibalism in Africa. In fact, if you read a book called Maneater, there's more references to Europeans eating each other in the cold than there is Africans eating each other in the warm. Why are you going to have a need to eat each other when the Creator and the sun has given you mango and peanuts and food to eat that comes to you plentifully? There's no evidence of it, but again, to denigrate Africa and Africans, they have to create an image that people are going to shy away from.
There's so many fallacies about African people and African history and culture, and cannibalism is one example. You know, based on my study, I found more evidence of cannibalism practiced among Europeans in Virginia in the 1600s. There are documented cases of the first settlers coming to Virginia from England, coming here in fall and in the dead of winter, and not having enough supplies to see them through that season. So there's documented instances of people exhuming the bodies of the dead and eating them. There's one particular instance, I forget the gentleman's name, but actually I read this in the National Geographic magazine, about a man whose wife died, and he kept her death a secret so that he could eat her corpse and survive the winter.
The cannibalism was going on in Europe big time. There's a lot of evidence showing the cannibalism that was going on in Europe. As a matter of fact, this whole vampire phenomenon that we have is rooted in the cannibalism that was going on in Europe in the Middle Ages. One of the most famous vampires, Dracula, Count Dracula, is really based on a real person named Vlad Dracula, who's also known as Vlad the Impaler. And there's a very famous portrait of Vlad the Impaler from around 1499, sometime in the 1400s, showing him and these people that he impaled on the stake. But they only show half of this portrait, because when you pan out of this portrait, you'll see Vlad the Impaler literally at a dinner table eating the body parts. And I mean, he has like knife, fork, salt and pepper, like he's at Applebee's or Denny's or something.
You have to remember, at the time, Isabella, or the queen at the time, put a bounty on slaves. And part of the edict that she sent out was, anyone or any of the people that you catch who are cannibals, you can enslave them. So now everybody would say, okay, they were cannibals.
Another myth about Africa is that it's extremely violent. Whenever we see anything about Africa, especially movies and the news, we always see the African warlord. We always see the African rebels riding on trucks, the African rebels with rocket launchers and machine guns. So what they do, the Western media, they'll take footage of a war-torn area. And the footage might even be old. They'll get old footage and show war-torn areas of Africa. They did that with the Kony 2012 propaganda not too long ago. And they'll try to pretend that this is what all of Africa is like. But in reality, out of the top 10 countries around the world with the lowest violent crime rates, 6 of those countries are in Africa, like Senegal, Cameroon, Mali. A lot of people don't know that. In an attempt for Western powers and European historians to distance Africa from Egypt, because they try to pretend that Egypt and the rest of Africa is totally different. So what they did, they created something called the Sub-Saharan African, meaning that the Africans below the Sahara Desert were somehow disconnected from the Africans in the north. Africans have always interacted with each other all over Africa. Africans have always moved around Africa. Even the Sahara Desert, it was not always a desert, number one. Number two, the Nile River goes from North Africa right into Southern Africa. So if they wanted to go back and forth from North Africa to Southern Africa, they can just take the Nile River.
Now, one of the things we have to be concerned about is the concerted effort to take Egypt out of Africa. And so many times when people speak of Africa, they exclude Egypt. And I think, and many people I think would agree with me, many of my colleagues and contemporaries, they would say that excluding Egypt from Africa would be like taking Greece and Rome out of Europe. It's just a huge void.
The more south you go, the more African-centered you'll get. As you move more north, Their attachment to those structures are just not there. There's a lot of reasons why that happens, just in terms of they know it's not them. They know it's not their mindset. They know that they want to exploit it, but they do not know it. It is not part of them. They are an invading force. For them to be in Egypt today is equivalent to Europeans claiming America of 3,000 years ago.
And they could care less about those temples because, number one, they didn't build them. And from an Islamic perspective, they really wouldn't like to see them in existence. The reason they're there is because they are a moneymaker for the Egyptian government. Let's be clear.
A lot of the Egyptians that are there in Egypt now, they're invaders. They came later on down the line. They're not the ancient Egyptians. They're not connected to the ancient Egyptians, and they know that. When they're over there, they don't respect the ancient monuments as their own. Like, when you go to the mosque over there, they respect the mosque. They're not over there smoking cigarettes. They're not selling things in front of the mosque. But when you go to the pyramids and you go to the museums, you go to the Sphinx, people, they're out there hustling. They're out there trying to sell you things. They're smoking cigarettes. They're out there running scams. They're running game on you.
Right.
Can you see this picture? We know this picture?
Yes. Well, let me see that. Who is that? Hold on.
Mr. Obama.
That's Barack Obama?
Obama was my father.
No,
Barack Obama was your father?
Yeah, in the Panorama place.
Oh,
maybe later.
When the white scientists go into the temples of Kemet to excavate and clean up the walls and temples and make them visitable and inhabitable, they are changing the color of the actual paintings of the Africans on the wall. There was an entire report that came out how the scientific excavators in the temples of Kemet were lightening up the images on the wall, the Medu Netcher. So you have black images, and they're using chemicals that actually turn the black image tan.
Professor Smalls told me when he went to study over there, he said the reason why we over here in the West are so caught up with ancient Kemet is because the seeds of Kemet, after Kemet was destroyed, all were driven to the south and to the west of Africa. And during the time of the slave trade, the strangers were the ones that they gave up first. So the people who actually are the ones that were brought over here were the remnants from ancient Kemet. They too, the people of Mali and the people of these areas that you're seeing with the Dogon, they say that the Dogon themselves are the forgotten parts of those tribes that actually ended up or who were driven out of ancient Kemet.
The Dogon were a group of Africans from the West Coast who had in fact been able to achieve a degree of astrological superiority and dominance that we really don't see a contemporary for or precedent for other than what was achieved in Navali civilization.
And people began to chase the Dogon to examine them because you couldn't figure out how these so-called primitive Africans would have knowledge of astronomy, particularly the white dwarf star Sirius B, that Western astronomy itself is only coming to grips with. And so the Dogon have developed a kind of, I almost said infamy in the world. In fact, there's even a book called The Sirius Mystery, and it's about how the Dogon, these primitive Africans, could have knowledge of a star system that's invisible to the naked eye. So the Dogon are black people in Mali with an astronomical lore.
Whenever we see people in Africa, we always see the AIDS-infested African babies, the African people. But what they do not talk about is the AIDS that's going on in Europe. Most people don't know that most of the new AIDS cases today are not in Africa. Most of the new AIDS cases today are coming out of Eastern Europe, out of Russia, the Ukraine, and there's an AIDS epidemic over there in that area, but you never hear about it in the media.
Nations are invaded at the end of their power. If you look at all of the great nations that rose, when nations are invaded, the nation itself is sick already. Only dying nations are invaded. Nations act like animals to each other. If the state is strong, which means it is in a constant state of war, it is continuously fending off what it doesn't want. And not war, always shooting and killing. Commerce wars, trade wars, competitions, even sports. The state is always in a constant push off, and let in. We want this. Acquisition. We want that. We want that. We going to take that. Give and take. When another state starts to get weak because its people are unskilled, becomes ignorant, betray the king or queen or the ruling class, or the ruling class becomes tyrant and the people can't control the people anymore, any of these things, you lose your resources, starts to deteriorate. The minute your state starts to deteriorate, other states are looking at you. It ain't got nothing to do with we love you, we knew you, we know your family. As a matter of fact, we'll take you in. You go into exile and come on into our state. And come on in. But we taking your land, your resources. Why? Because you weak.
How can Africa be so poor and yet be materially so rich? It's real simple. The answer lies in the Structural Adjustment Program, SAP, the structural adjustment programs that are imposed on African nations by the International Monetary Fund of Washington, D.C., the World Bank of Washington, D.C., and USAID. These three organizations come into Africa, loan money, and then charge an interest rate on that money that they know the African nations can never pay back, thusly re-enslaving the entire nation and, in fact, the entire continent.
I point out that when Spanish, English, Dutch explorers would go through, let's say, the Americas, there's a good example here for the African continent, many of the places they arrived at were already abandoned. Our tribes' leaders, our kings and queens, our priests, traveled the world. They were literate. They read and spoke many languages. They heard and knew. These guys are coming to take over the land. They got weird weapons, and this is what they're going to do. They went back to their tribe, told everybody, gather up your stuff. We have to leave. There is an invading force coming. We have to go. So many tribes were warned. When this invading force came, many times they came and found the place deserted and just claimed it as their own.
Why was Muammar Gaddafi killed? Muammar Gaddafi was murdered because he, along with the other African heads of state, were about to bring into existence Africa's first central bank. They were erecting a central bank in Africa, which was going to do what? Back its money to the resources under the ground in Africa. Now, what would that have done to the global economic order? Remember, the United States dollar isn't backed on any natural resource. The British pound isn't backed on any natural resource. The Canadian dollar, the European Union, their currency isn't backed on any natural resource because Europe doesn't have a lot of natural resources. Africa does. So if they would have been successful in creating a central bank of Africa, coming up with a unitary currency, and then backing that currency to the material wealth under the soil, they would have bankrupted every other economic system in this world, from America to Europe to China. That was revolution, and that's why Muammar Gaddafi had to be assassinated, because he was about to help the African heads of state eliminate modern slavery and neocolonialism from the continent.
One of the things that you find is that European culture begins to take off after the first civilized Europeans, the Greeks, make contact with Kemet or Egypt.
Greeks themselves were not white people, and even today, you any Greek, I was in the military, I was stationed in Athens and Piraeus. We know we're cousins. Let's stop playing.
We still have black Greeks living in Greece right now to this day, and people pretend they don't know where they came from, but there are black Greek people living in Greece right now.
People of Ireland long before, and the people of Scotland long before the Romans came, were already African people. Why you, if you see a picture of a Scottish person, there's always somebody with like this real thick black hair, right? And this real thick black, what do you think they're trying to tell you?
You know, they came out with a report a few years ago saying that King Tut shared DNA with men up in Britain. And the thing is, the Egyptians went into Britain, particularly Scotland, later on down the line. As a matter of fact, Scotland is named after an Egyptian princess, Scotia. And Many of the descendants of those Egyptians are there to this day, but they're now known as gypsies. And the term gypsy is just a variation of the word Egyptian.
Whites have long hair, blacks have short curly hair. What is the reason for that? Black's hair, your follicle, my follicle, is not round. It's flat, like a ribbon. So you know how Christmas you rub your hand on the ribbon and it curls up? Well, that's the way our hair do. White hair is like a soda straw. It's round, so it hangs. What is the purpose for that? All of the main arteries that take the messages and information from the brain to the rest of the body pass through the human neck. So if you're caught in an ice age, you've got to grow enough hair to shield the neck, to insulate the neck. Otherwise, you're going to die. Same thing with the nostrils. When you're in the sun of Africa, you need these big nostrils we have because you got to cool the brain down. But if you're in Europe and all that ice, you don't want to cool the brain down. So you need a smaller nostril bridge so you can warm the air up that's coming in. These simple physical anthropological realities.
The Greeks lost their history, all of it. Okay, the Greeks lost all their history. You know who had their history? The Arabs had the Greeks' history. The reason we know Greek history is because of Islam. Because of the Arabs. The Arabs revered Greek history. And what the Greeks were doing and all their philosophies, they wrote it all down. Then Greece lost their history through wars and this and that and the other. And they regained their history because of Arabic texts.
Oh, thank heaven for 7-Eleven. Oh, thank heaven for 7-Eleven. What's 7-Eleven? 7-Eleven was when the Moors, Africans from Morocco, which is where the word Moor comes from, but Africans from northern Africa went across the Iberian Peninsula, which is a very short distance, into Europe. And they brought culture. They brought writing. They brought civilization. And they brought Europe out of the Dark Ages.
It was the Romans that began to call the black people in Africa. Because remember, that day we didn't speak English. So if you don't speak English, you're not going to call yourself black. Right? So if you don't speak a traditional African language or Portuguese or Spanish, you will not call yourself Negro. At that time, Spanish was not dominant, so there's no Negro, there's no Portuguese. At that time, English is not dominant, so there's no black. At that time, the Romans were the dominant force, and the Roman word for black persons was Maurish, coming from the Greek roots for black.
They occupied Portugal. They occupied parts of southern France.
Up until 1700s, all the medical books on surgery and general medicine in Europe was written in Arabic. Isn't that extraordinary? All of the major universities of Europe, where the physicians and the scientists and the teachers were all studying, was in Spain and Portugal, run by the Africans that the West call Moors. And the reason the West keep emphasizing them as Moors, they don't want you to see that this is the same African we got enslaved that gave us all the wealth of knowledge that allowed us to enslave you.
At this time in Europe, we're talking the early 8th century, most European kings and queens could neither read or write. The Moors build vast libraries. Anybody, irrespective of your religion, you could practice your religious faith, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, in relative freedom. We find Moors in the army of the Spanish Emperor Trajan. In fact, in Italy, you have what's called Trajan's Column, and you can see more clearly Moorish soldiers on horseback on that column. You can go to Rome and see it for yourself. You have at least one emperor in Rome of Moorish ancestry. His name is Macrinus. He's specifically described as a Moor. You have other high-ranking Moors in the Roman army.
The Moors were known for building castles all throughout Europe, and some of those same castles can actually be found around North Africa. They call them desert castles or kazirs, but there are castles all around Africa.
The heart and soul, the thought, the mind that built the castles came from Africa. And they went through Europe and they built them. They built them straight through Spain, straight through Portugal, going up into France, going up into other parts of the world.
The earliest examples of castle building are found in an area that is now known as Nubia. If you were to go to the Nubia Museum in Aswan, Egypt,
you'll find a model of a castle complete with a moat, drawbridge, fortifications, all of the architectural elements that we associate with castles in any part of Europe existed in Africa as late as 1800 BC, before there was civilization in Europe.
The Moors are described in English literature or European literature as black as pitch, black as a crow, black as a raven, black as ink, nothing white about them but their teeth.
The monument that we know is Stonehenge. A European writer by the name of Gerald Massey said in one of his books that Stonehenge was built by an African man named Morion. Now, this is from a European writer, because a lot of times when black historians say something like this, it's written off as being Afrocentric. But European writers and several other European writers say that African people built Stonehenge and other monuments up in Europe.
Only when the enslavement of Africans started to produce wealth for Europe that this notion of color racism began to become a reality. Most of the great saints of Europe are black. Almost every church in Europe have a black Madonna and child.
Saint Calogero was another patron saint of Italy. He was a black man, and there's black statues of this man all over Italy, and there's paintings of Saint Calogero all over Italy and Sicily. They worship this man in Sicily. They still have statues of many Moors up in Europe today. They have a statue of Saint Benedict that was made in the 1700s. There's another bust carving of St. Gregory that's in a museum in Germany. So there's statues of Moors and African people all over Europe to this day that you can see, but you got to go to museums to see them. They're very quiet about them. You have to go over there, and also you have to learn about these things in different languages, because they keep that history hidden because they'll put it in another language. The Ivory Bangle Lady was an African woman whose tomb they found up in the York area of Britain. Now, whenever they find African people in Britain, what they would normally do is just try to write them off as being slaves. Or they might have been a slave. It's a possibility that they were slaves. But with the Ivory Bangle Lady, they couldn't write her off as a slave because it showed that she had so much wealth, she could not have possibly been a slave. The way her tomb was made, it was made out of stone, which showed wealth. Inside the tomb, it had all types of artifacts and jewelry, like ivory bangles and necklaces and bracelets on her wrists. And it showed that this woman was extremely wealthy. Johannes Morris was a 13th century high-ranking official in Italy. And there's a carving, a statue of him at a museum in Italy right now. And this statue of Johannes Morris shows his clearly African features, African nose, African lips, African hair.
Look at the countries that are falling. Almost by chronology, they're falling the same way they invaded Africa. Greece is falling, Italy is falling, Spain is falling, Persia is falling. And it's all because what goes around comes around. No hocus pocus, no mumbo jumbo, this is just the way it is. You shall reap what you sow. That's not a biblical term, that's a scientific term.
When you read the European philosophers, what did they say? They often said that Africa had two great civilizations, Egypt in the north and Asia in the south. The white man said this. So they often, in ancient times, Asia was considered a part of Africa or Africa's second civilization. They said that you go to Asia and it's nothing but a carbon copy of Africa because it was settled by the Africans.
A lot of people don't know that there are pyramids all over Asia, and there are pyramids in China. In Japan, they have an underwater pyramid that a lot of people don't know about, and you can go there now, and that's one of those ancient mysteries. But again, pyramids are all over the planet.
So in Asia today, you have pockets of black people. You have the Mani. You have in southern Thailand, you have a related group in northern Malaysia, sometimes called Sekai, S-E-K-A-I. You have the Andaman Islanders, and there are at least two groups. One group is called the Onje, O-N-G-E, or O-N-J-E, I think it's O-N-G-E, and another is called the Jarawa, J-A-R-A-W-A. And then you have black populations in the Philippines. sometimes called Negritos or Eta, or I think we should call them Akta, which just means the people. You have a tradition of a similar group in Taiwan. These are the diminutive Afrikaners. These are the small blacks, similar in many ways to the Twa or so-called Pygmies in Central Africa. These are very, very ancient people who left Africa perhaps 60, 70, maybe 100,000 years ago and became isolated.
The Padong people, that's a group of people in Asia, and they, the women have these rings that they wear on their necks that's identical to an African tribe of women in East Africa who wear the same type of rings on their necks. So this just shows that the African-Asian connection is still there. They still carry on some of the African cultures and traditions in certain parts of Asia.
I once had a professor of mine working on my doctorate tell me that she went to Japan and they went into the mountains of Japan. Now this isn't a conscious woman by most definitions, but she couldn't wait to come back and tell me this. She said, Umar, I was in Japan. We went up into the spiritual temples of Japan and we sat down in one of the temples waiting for the priest to come out and teach us a little bit about what they believe and what they stand for. She said, Umar, they walked out of the temples and their skin was just as black as ours. They had gray afros because they were elders. Now she said the phenotype looked like the modern Asian. But she said the skin was black and they had gray afros, hair standing up on top like Don King. And she said it totally overcame me. They sat down and they began to talk. And she said, I couldn't believe these were black men. They were Japanese, but they were black men.
When I went over to Indonesia, I went there at night and I would see billboards of very light-skinned Asian Indonesian people. And then when I went to my hotel, I would go and watch these movies and I would see these very, again, light-skinned, pale-skinned Indonesian Asian people. But the next day when I went out into the streets of Indonesia, everybody was either my color or darker. I didn't see one person who looked like these people that were on the billboards and on television. So they would pick and choose and get the whitest looking Asian people to promote in the media over there. And when I walked around Indonesia, I saw people like jet black, dark. I ran into a couple of people with afros. I saw one Asian brother, full-blooded Asian guy with an afro, and I had to stop him. I said, brother, where are you from? And the brother was like, I'm from here, right here in Indonesia. So that African presence, that African phenotype, is still throughout Asia to this day.
Look at the Buddha's hair. No Chinese person's hair looked like that. The Buddha has knotty hair. Every time you see the Buddha, his hair is knotted. Just a thought.
There's a painting called the Nambam painting of the Portuguese when they first go over to Japan. And when you look at this painting, the painting was made in around sometime in the 1500s, and it was the first eyewitness account of what they saw. Many of the Asian people there were dark-skinned, and half the people who were supposed to be Portuguese were dark-skinned.
There's a tradition begun by a man named Alexander Francis Chamberlain, at least in April 1914, in a publication called the Journal of Race Development. And I can quote him almost exactly. And he says, and even in far-off Japan, we can find traces of the ancient Negro. For when the Japanese armies in the 8th century, now here I'm paraphrasing, when the Japanese armies in the 8th century were fighting their traditional enemy, the Ainu, they were led by a famous Negro general named Sakanoye Tomomoraro. And this man became the first shogun in Japanese history.
Also in Malaysia, when I went down to Malaysia, I went into the rainforest over there. And it's very difficult to get over to some of these spots. Some of these people there are very secluded. And because they're secluded, they were able to avoid many natural disasters, and they were also able to avoid invasions. So they didn't mix in with some of the invading forces, so they kept their same African phenotype. And if you go to Malaysia, there's a tribe called the Batak tribe. And they look like an African tribe. If you go there, they have woolly hair, African nose, lips, everything about these people looks like an African tribe.
one of the things we know about white supremacy and light skin supremacy, because even when you look at Asia, even when you go to East India, they practice racism. Why? Because all of these places were colonized by the European and their culture infected the people. So one of the things that they do is they also have a tendency to do what? Hide the darker brother.
As a matter of fact, there was an incident that happened with Miss Fiji. They had the Miss World competition, and they chose this woman to be Miss Fiji. And Miss Fiji has more Europeanized features. And the people of Fiji spoke out against her. They weren't really trying to hate on her, but they said, look, this woman doesn't represent us. She doesn't look like us. She doesn't have our nose. She doesn't have our hair. And we're very proud of what we look like, and we want somebody to represent us. Because, again, they were trying to use that Europeanized Miss Fiji to bring in tourism and not scare away tourists. But the people spoke out against her. And this just shows that many people around the world, they're proud of their Africoid features. One of the oldest groups of people to inhabit India were a group of black-skinned people called the Dravidians, or the Untouchables. Now, when people think about the history and the culture of India, they oftentimes think of Mahatma Gandhi. And many people give praises and accolades to Mahatma Gandhi because of Dr. Martin Luther King. But what many people do not know is that Gandhi had very racist views towards black people.
The truth behind Mahatma Gandhi. First of all, I'm reluctant to use the word Mahatma. Mahatma means great soul. And many of my Indian colleagues would say he wasn't even an ordinary soul, much less a great soul.
The late, great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. put that picture of Mahatma Gandhi up in his office and said that he got the operational technique for nonviolence from Mahatma Gandhi. It was somewhat premature for the ancestor, who's one of my favorites, but it was premature because now you automatically set the stage where African people would start looking to Mahatma Gandhi also. For example, last spring, last Black History Month, I was in Atlanta. I went to the Dr. Martin Luther King Shrine where he and Queen Mother Coretta are buried, and across the street is a museum. Outside the museum is a life-size statue of Mahatma Gandhi. I couldn't believe it. This is a museum dedicated to the honor of Dr. King. But there's no statue of Dr. King outside of a museum erected in his honor. Instead, you have a life-size statue of Mahatma Gandhi. So the message to the child is what? That it was really Mahatma Gandhi who's responsible for you coming through the civil rights struggle, not Dr. King. Now, had Dr. King knew Mahatma Gandhi's true racist thinking and ideology, I'm sure he would have thought otherwise. As a psychologist, you can never know how what's really at the root of somebody's thinking. I would argue that we should never make a hero of any other people. Mahatma Gandhi turned his back on Africans. Even when he came back to India and began fighting, he refused to give support to the African emancipation movement. And on more than one occasion, he had made derogatory remarks about Africans. And we also know the Dravidians of India. The Africans of India who are oppressed, were oppressed, and have always been oppressed in India, there is no record anywhere of Mahatma Gandhi fighting against the oppression of Indians in India who were black, the so-called Dravidians. Why didn't he speak out for them? Why didn't he speak out for Africans who were fighting against colonialism? Why didn't Mahatma Gandhi help our brothers and sisters in South Africa? It's because he was a racist like the rest of them.
Australia itself is the world's second smallest continent, second only after Antarctica. It's the smallest inhabited continent. The name Australia means Great South Land. And the first people of Australia were the people we call Aboriginal Australians, commonly called Blackfellas. And of course you have different names, the Koori, the Guri, the Noongar, and various names.
The people of Australia, originally Australia was an African land. In fact, in European documentation, they considered it an African satellite. When the British came into Australia and began the mass extermination of African people, they were crystal clear who they were exterminating because they said it. And also we know that right off the coast of Australia was an island called Tasmania. a little island off the coast of Tasmania. There are no living Tasmanians in existence right now. You can't find a Tasmanian man, woman, or child because the British systematically exterminated the entire population.
It wasn't until January 1967 that Aboriginal people in Australia were considered humans for the first time. In January 1967, there was a national referendum to decide that Aboriginal Australians should have Australian citizenship. Up to that point, they were officially, and you can document this, classified as flora and fauna and plants and animals.
In Australia, they would literally breed out the melanin of the people. You know, they would have these, they would take the children and take them to breeding camps and breeding farms and breed the darker ones and the mulatto ones with white, and they would literally breed the melanin out of these people. The movie Rabbit Proof Fence is about that breeding process, them breeding out the melanin of the Aboriginal people. So it was very deep what was going on over there.
You have three major island chains: North Pacific, West Pacific, and South Pacific. Melanesia, Polynesia, Micronesia. Melanesia is the South Pacific. Those are, that means the black islands. And the biggest island is New Guinea. Others include New Caledonia, New Ireland, New Britain, Fiji, the Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, which used to be known as New Hebrides. These are the black islands. And the people that I've encountered in this part of the world tend to say they come from Africa. People tend to have very, very Afrikoid features. Dark skin, tightly curled hair, you know, large afros, we call them today. Many of them say they come from Africa, especially in Fiji. And also in Buka Island. I ask people, where do you come from? We come from Africa. And they're very matter-of-fact about it. Buka, B-U-K, means black skin. And they have the reputation of being the blackest human beings on Earth. So quite naturally, that was where I wanted to lay my head. If you look at images of King Kamehameha, and I know you have, who is the what might be considered the founder of Hawaii, like the founding father of Hawaii, clearly Afrikoid.
One of the most famous Hawaiians is a guy named Duke Kahanamoku. Duke was one of the forefathers of modern surfing, and they would use Duke to promote tourism in Hawaii. They would send Duke to the continental United States to promote swimming in Hawaii and surfing, and Duke had problems getting into swimming areas when he came to the continental U.S. because people thought that he was black because he was so dark, and many of the native Hawaiians, they have that dark African phenotype. If you go to places like Maui and some of the remote areas of Hawaii, they look like black people, just like Samoans. You go to Samoa, they look like black people over here in America.
I'm doing an interview, a call-in thing, and somebody called in and says, you know, I'm a Hawaiian. And he says, the problem was you just didn't meet the right people. I said, really? He says, when I was a young boy, my grandmother used to tell me that when Kamehameha was trying to unite the Hawaiian Islands, this is around 1815, that he ran into trouble and he sent back to Africa for reinforcements. He said that was a Hawaiian tradition.
African people, they've been coming to the Americas for years, thousands of years before Europeans. And this is why many Europeans knew how to get over to the Americas based on maps that African people left for centuries.
We wear the gene pool of the Native American population. We wear the gene pool of the African, which is called Moors, who had preceded Columbus to this country. And we wear the gene pool of those Africans who came from the continent. And so we felt that this land, and I do now still feel this land is ours. I'm an African American. Africa is my race. America is my geopolitical place. I'm not surrendering that to anybody.
One of the things we know is there are Europeans who wrote books about the African presence in America before Columbus, but it's difficult to actually get your hands on some of the copies of these books. They're real hard to find because it wasn't popular for white folk or black folk, but especially white scientists, to say that African folk, that Moorish people were in America prior to the European coming here.
There are three belts that leave the coast of Africa. There's one that's in the north, there's one in the middle, and there's one in the south. When you look at this middle one literally will take you right into the Gulf of Mexico, even if you didn't have power, boat. And what's going to happen is the Africans are going to start to move into this area here, and they're going to begin to settle in this corner of the Gulf of Mexico. They're going to develop, according to what our research shows, three major cities: Tres Zapotes, San Lorenzo, okay, and La Venta.
If you go to Mexico, southern Mexico now, especially in the provinces and towns in southwest Mexico, they tell you there's two black people there, the ones that came on the ship, meaning those who were enslaved, and the ones who came before the ship, meaning those like the Olmecs and others who had been here at a point where no one know when that genesis was. They just were always here.
The Olmec problem was that European scientists, after finding it, it was found by a little farmer who was clearing the land for him to grow some maize and grow his corn. And he found what looked like an upside-down pot. And when he called the owner of the land over, they found out what it was, and he excavated it, and they found this gigantic head. Now, that was back early in 1837 or 1897 or something around that time. When they found that and they saw this Africoid face, that completely turned everything around, because they thought the Mayan civilization was the oldest civilization here. Now, when they found that the Mayan civilization was not the oldest civilization, and that Africans all through the histories were supposedly brought here as slaves, they did not want to fess up and change their whole curriculum to state that there was an African civilization in the Americas some 5,000, 10,000 years ago. The other part of it is that during the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, the Vatican put out an edict very quietly that all Western books and academia had to first be passed through the Vatican census. So the Vatican said that any evidence of black history here had to be taken off of the history book. This man, Coe, who essentially became the top man that you went to see about Mesoamerican civilization, he worked for the CIA.
When I was down there in Mexico, I saw one Olmec statue. It was very interesting to me. It had the face of an African person, and the name of the statue was actually called Monkey Looking in the Sky. And what they would do, they would try to pretend that a lot of these statues were actually animals. Like the Olmec heads, they would try to say that they were jaguars and they were aliens from outer space. The European archaeologists would try to make up anything to say that they were not black. But this one statue called Monkey Looking in the Sky, it's clearly not a monkey, because first of all, monkeys don't have full lips, and it looks like a person. It is a person. And this just goes to show the depths that these archaeologists will go to deny the African history.
One of the earliest groups that I can find archaeologically would be the Folsom people, F-O-L-S-O-M. That's why you go out, you look at your map, you find great various areas that are called the Folsom areas, Folsom, Arizona, Folsom, Nevada. You go out in New Mexico, find Folsom Prison, and you find one. And one of the biggest archaeological and oldest digs in America is called the Folsom Archaeological Findings out there, where they found all these African artifacts in the ground. And that was 16,000 years ago. 6,000 years ago, Asians began to migrate across the Bering Straits into the United States, and they came into the United States across the Bering Straits into Canada, then down to the northern part of the United States, and down into the southern part, and they interbred and met and interbred with blacks, those Folsom people. And otherwise, that's why American Indians never had slant eyes and were never yellow skin. They became round-eyed and brown skin and red skin.
All over the country of Costa Rica, you have these little African-like statues just all over the place. And when you go to the museums, you see these African artifacts, African-style gold, a lot of monuments and artifacts that resemble monuments and artifacts from West Africa.
You have one part of the Mississippi River go one way, the other part goes the other way. In the Y of that split, you have a place that Native Americans call Cahokia. Today it's called Collinsville, Illinois. It's near St. Louis. This is where you have the largest pyramid in the Northern Hemisphere. It's called Monk's Mound.
If you look at pictures from the 1900s and beyond, most of the Native American people were very dark-skinned. Sometimes they were very jet black. But most Native American people before 1900, if you look at photos of them, they're extremely dark-skinned people, especially on the West Coast, like in California. The California Indians were very dark-skinned. The Indians that were around the Minnesota, Milwaukee area that we know as Milwaukee and Minnesota now, they were very dark-skinned people. The Native Americans on the East Coast were very dark-skinned people.
Caller, go ahead. Hello, caller? Hello?
One of the temples waiting for the priest to come out and teach us a little bit about what they believe in. One of the temples waiting for the priest to come out and teach us a little bit about what they believe and what they stand for. She said, Umar, they walked out of the temples and their skin was just as black as ours. They had gray afros because they were elders. Now she said the phenotype looked like the modern Asian. But she said the skin was black and they had gray afros, hair standing up on top like Don King. And she said it totally overcame me. They sat down and they began to talk. And she said I couldn't believe these were black men. They were Japanese, but they were black men.
When I went over to Indonesia, I went there at night and I would see billboards of very light-skinned Asian Indonesian people. And then when I went to my hotel, I would go and watch these movies, and I would see these very, again, light-skinned, pale-skinned Indonesian Asian people. But the next day when I went out into the streets of Indonesia, everybody was either my color or darker. I didn't see one person who looked like these people that were on the billboards and on television. So they would pick and choose and get the whitest-looking Asian people to promote in the media over there. And when I walked around Indonesia, I saw people like jet black, dark. I ran into a couple of people with afros. I saw one Asian brother, full-blooded Asian guy with an afro, and I had to stop him. I said, brother, where are you from? And the brother was like, I'm from here, right here in Indonesia. So that African presence, that African phenotype, is still throughout Asia to this day.
Look at the Buddha's hair. No Chinese person's hair looked like that. The Buddha has knotty hair. Every time you see the Buddha, his hair is knotted. Just a thought.
There's a painting called the Nambam painting of the Portuguese when they first go over to Japan. And when you look at this painting, the painting was made in around sometime in the 1500s, and it was the first eyewitness account of what they saw. Many of the Asian people there were dark-skinned, and half the people who were supposed to be Portuguese were dark-skinned.
There's a tradition begun by a man named Alexander Francis Chamberlain, at least in April 1914, in a publication called the Journal of Race Development. And I can quote him almost exactly. And he says, and even in far-off Japan, we can find traces of the ancient Negro. For when the Japanese armies in the 8th century, now here I'm paraphrasing, when the Japanese armies in the 8th century were fighting their traditional enemy, the Ainu, they were led by a famous Negro general named Sakanoye Tomomoraro. And this man became the first shogun in Japanese history.
Also in Malaysia, when I went down to Malaysia, I went into the rainforest over there. And it's very difficult to get over to some of these spots. Some of these people there are very secluded. And because they're secluded, they were able to avoid many natural disasters, and they were also able to avoid invasions. So they didn't mix in with some of the invading forces, so they kept their same African phenotype. And if you go to Malaysia, there's a tribe called the Batak tribe, and they look like an African tribe. If you go there, they have woolly hair, African nose, lips, everything about these people looks like an African tribe. One of the things we know about white supremacy and light-skinned supremacy, because even when you look at Asia, even when you go to East India, they practice racism. Why? Because all of these places were colonized by the European, and their culture infected the people. So one of the things that they do is they also have a tendency to do what? Hide the darker brother.
As a matter of fact, there was an incident that happened with Miss Fiji. They had the Miss World competition, and they chose this woman to be Miss Fiji. And Miss Fiji has more Europeanized features. And the people of Fiji spoke out against her. They weren't really trying to hate on her, but they said, look, this woman doesn't represent us. She doesn't look like us. She doesn't have our nose. She doesn't have our hair. And we're very proud of what we look like, and we want somebody to represent us. Because, again, they were trying to use that Europeanized Miss Fiji to bring in tourism and not scare away tourists, but the people spoke out against her. And this just shows that many people around the world, they're proud of their Africoid features. One of the oldest groups of people to inhabit India were a group of black-skinned people called the Dravidians, or the Untouchables. Now, when people think about the history and the culture of India, they oftentimes think of Mahatma Gandhi. And many people give praises and accolades to Mahatma Gandhi because of Dr. Martin Luther King. But what many people do not know is that Gandhi had very racist views towards black people.
The truth behind Mahatma Gandhi. First of all, I'm reluctant to use the word Mahatma. Mahatma means great soul. And many of my Indian colleagues would say he wasn't even an ordinary soul, much less a great soul.
The late, great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. put that picture of Mahatma Gandhi up in his office and said that he got the operational technique for nonviolence from Mahatma Gandhi. It was somewhat premature for the ancestor, who's one of my favorites, but it was premature because now you automatically set the stage where African people would start looking to Mahatma Gandhi also. For example, last spring, last Black History Month, I was in Atlanta. I went to the Dr. Martin Luther King Shrine, where he and Queen Mother Coretta are buried, and across the street is a museum. Outside the museum is a life-size statue of Mahatma Gandhi. I couldn't believe it. This is a museum dedicated to the honor of Dr. King. But there's no statue of Dr. King outside of a museum erected in his honor. Instead, you have a life-size statue of Mahatma Gandhi. So the message to the child is what? That it was really Mahatma Gandhi who's responsible for you coming through the civil rights struggle, not Dr. King. Now, had Dr. King knew Mahatma Gandhi's true racist thinking and ideology, I'm sure he would have thought otherwise. As a psychologist, you can never know how what's really at the root of somebody's thinking. I would argue that we should never make a hero of any other people. Mahatma Gandhi turned his back on Africans. Even when he came back to India and began fighting, he refused to give support to the African emancipation movement. And on more than one occasion, he had made derogatory remarks about Africans. And we also know the Dravidians of India. The Africans of India who are oppressed, were oppressed, and have always been oppressed in India. There is no record anywhere of Mahatma Gandhi fighting against the oppression of Indians in India who were black, the so-called Dravidians. Why didn't he speak out for them? Why didn't he speak out for Africans who were fighting against colonialism? Why didn't Mahatma Gandhi help our brothers and sisters in South Africa? It's because he was a racist like the rest of them.
First of all, Australia itself is the world's second smallest continent, second only after Antarctica. It's the smallest inhabited continent. The name Australia means Great South Land. And the first people of Australia were the people we call Aboriginal Australians, commonly called black fellas. And of course, you have different names, the Koori, the Guri, the Noongar, and various names.
The people of Australia, originally Australia was an African land. In fact, in European documentation, they considered it an African satellite. When the British came into Australia and began the mass extermination of African people, they were crystal clear who they were exterminating because they said it. And also we know that right off the coast of Australia was an island called Tasmania, a little island off the coast of Tasmania. There are no living Tasmanians in existence right now. You can't find a Tasmanian man, woman, or child because the British systematically exterminated the entire population.
It wasn't until January 1967 that Aboriginal people in Australia were considered humans for the first time. In January 1967, there was a national referendum to decide if Aboriginal Australians should have Australian citizenship. Up to that point, they were officially, and you can document this, classified as flora and fauna and plants and animals.
In Australia, they would literally breed out the melanin of the people. You know, they would have these, they would take the children and take them to breeding camps and breeding farms and breed the darker ones and the mulatto ones with white. And they would literally breed the melanin out of these people. The movie Rabbit Proof Fence is about that breeding process, them breeding out the melanin of the Aboriginal people. So it was very deep what was going on over there.
You have three major island chains, North Pacific, West Pacific, and South Pacific, Melanesia, Polynesia, Micronesia. Melanesia is the South Pacific. That means the black islands. And the biggest island is New Guinea. Others include New Caledonia, New Ireland, New Britain, Fiji, the Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, which used to be known as New Hebrides. These are the black islands. And the people that I've encountered in this part of the world tend to say they come from Africa. People tend to have very, very Africoid features. Dark skin, tightly curled hair, you know, large afros we call them today. Many of them say they come from Africa, especially in Fiji. And also in Buka Island. I ask people, where do you come from? We come from Africa. And they're very matter of fact about it. Buka, B-U-K, means black skin. And they have the reputation of being the blackest human beings on earth. So quite naturally, that was where I wanted to lay my head. Look at images of King Kamehameha, and I know you have, who might be considered the founder of Hawaii, like the founding father of Hawaii, clearly Africoid.
One of the most famous Hawaiians is a guy named Duke Kahanamoku. Duke was one of the forefathers of modern surfing, and they would use Duke to promote tourism in Hawaii. They would send Duke to the continental United States to promote swimming in Hawaii and surfing, and Duke had problems getting into swimming areas when he came to the continental U.S. because people thought that he was black because he was so dark, and many of the native Hawaiians, they have that dark African phenotype. If you go to places like Maui and some of the remote areas of Hawaii, they look like black people, just like Samoans. You go to Samoa, they look like black people over here in America.
I'm doing an interview, a call-in thing, and somebody called in and says, you know, I'm a Hawaiian. And he says, the problem was you just didn't meet the right people. I said, really? He says, when I was a young boy, my grandmother used to tell me that when Kamehameha was trying to unite the Hawaiian Islands, this is around 1815, that he ran into trouble and he sent back to Africa for reinforcements. He said that was a Hawaiian tradition.
African people, they've been coming to the Americas for years, thousands of years before Europeans. And this is why many Europeans knew how to get over to the Americas based on maps that African people left for centuries.
We wear the gene pool of the Native American population. We wear the gene pool of the African, which is called Moors, who had preceded Columbus to this country. And we wear the gene pool of those Africans who came from the continent. And so we felt that this land, and I do now still feel this land is ours. I'm an African American. Africa is my race. America is my geopolitical place. I'm not surrendering that to anybody.
One of the things we know is there are Europeans who wrote books about the African presence in America before Columbus, but it's difficult to actually get your hands on some of the copies of these books. They're real hard to find because it wasn't popular for white folk or black folk, but especially white scientists, to say that African folk, that Moorish people were in America prior to the European coming here.
There are three belts that leave the coast of Africa. There's one that's in the north, there's one in the middle, and there's one in the south. When you look at this middle one literally will take you right into the Gulf of Mexico, even if you didn't have power, boat. And what's going to happen is the Africans are going to start to move into this area here, and they're going to begin to settle in this corner of the Gulf of Mexico. They're going to develop, according to what our research shows, three major cities. Tres Zapotes, San Lorenzo, okay, and La Venta.
If you go to Mexico, southern Mexico now, especially in the provinces and towns in southwest Mexico, they tell you there's two black people there, the ones that came on the ship, meaning those who were enslaved, and the ones who came before the ship, meaning those like the Olmecs and others who had been here at a point where no one know when that genesis was. They just were always here.
The Olmec problem was that European scientists, after finding it, it was found by a little farmer who was clearing the land for him to grow some maize and grow his corn. And he found what looked like an upside-down pot. And when he called the owner of the land over, they found out what it was, and he excavated it, and they found this gigantic head. Now, that was back early in 1837 or 1897 or something around that time. When they found that and they saw this Africoid face, that completely turned everything around, because they thought the Mayan civilization was the oldest civilization here. Now, when they found that the Mayan civilization was not the oldest civilization, and that Africans all through the histories were supposedly brought here as slaves, they did not want to fess up and change their whole curriculum to state that there was an African civilization in the Americas some 5,000, 10,000 years ago. The other part of it is that during the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, the Vatican put out an edict very quietly that all Western books and academia had to first be passed through the Vatican census. So the Vatican said that any evidence of black history here had to be taken off of the history book. This man, Coe, who essentially became the top man that you went to see about Mesoamerican civilization, he worked for the CIA.
When I was down there in Mexico, I saw one Olmec statue. It was very interesting to me. It had the face of an African person, and the name of the statue was actually called Monkey Looking in the Sky. And what they would do, they would try to pretend that a lot of these statues were actually animals. Like the Olmec heads, they would try to say that they were jaguars and they were aliens from outer space. The European archaeologists would try to make up anything
to say that they were not black, but this one statue called Monkey Looking in the Sky is clearly not a monkey, because first of all, monkeys don't have full lips, and it looks like a person. It is a person. And this just goes to show the depths that these archaeologists will go to deny the African history.
One of the earliest groups that I can find archaeologically would be the Folsom people, F-O-L-S-O-M. That's why you go out, you look at your map, you find great various areas that we call the Folsom areas, Folsom, Arizona, Folsom, Nevada, Folsom, you go out in New Mexico, you find Folsom Prison, and you find one of the biggest archaeological and oldest digs in America is called the Folsom Archaeological Findings out there, where they found all these African artifacts in the ground. And that was 16,000 years ago. 6,000 years ago, Asians began to migrate across the Bering Straits into the United States, and they came into the United States across the Bering Straits into Canada, then down to the northern part of the United States, and down into the southern part, and they interbred and met and interbred with blacks, those Folsom people. And otherwise, that's why American Indians never had slant eyes and were never yellow skin. They became round-eyed and brown skin and red skin.
All over the country of Costa Rica, you have these little African-like statues just all over the place. And when you go to the museums, you see these African artifacts, African-style gold, a lot of monuments and artifacts that resemble monuments and artifacts from West Africa.
You have one part of the Mississippi River go one way, the other part goes the other way. In the Y of that split, you have a place that Native Americans call Cahokia. Today it's called Collinsville, Illinois. It's near St. Louis. This is where you have the largest pyramid in the Northern Hemisphere. It's called Monk's Mound.
If you look at pictures from the 1900s and beyond, most of the Native American people were very dark-skinned. Sometimes they were very jet black, but most Native American people before 1900, if you look at photos of them, they're extremely dark-skinned people, especially on the West Coast, like in California. The California Indians were very dark-skinned. The Indians that were around the Minnesota and Milwaukee area that we know as Milwaukee and Minnesota now, they were very dark-skinned people. The Native Americans on the East Coast were very dark-skinned people. In the late 1800s, there was something called the Dawes Rolls, which was basically a census that made records of people's ethnic backgrounds in order to determine which Native American tribes would get certain land allotments and other benefits. After slavery, many black people were associated with some of these tribes by bloodline, through marriage, through adoption, and even servitude. And because they were associated with these tribes, many black people were entitled to some of these benefits. The government did not want blacks to get these benefits, so they created a separate freedmen's list specifically for black people. They also started to list any full-blooded Native American who had African features as black because they didn't want them getting those benefits either. At the same time, they allowed white citizens to come in and pay money under the table to be listed as part Native American.
1895 and 1896, when a lot of the whites found out the benefits that these blacks are going to be entitled to, a lot of whites went to the Dawes Commission and said, look, why don't you put my name on there? And they said, but you're not an Indian. So they said, well, I'll give you $5. So the rule got around, the posse got around that for $5 that a white could put his name on the Dawes Rolls and be called himself an Indian and be entitled to all these benefits, and all their children could be entitled to all these benefits forever. And so that became known as what's called a $5 Indian. And so if you go around now and check most of the Indians, the so-called Indians in America, about 90% of them are not even Indians. Those are just whites now who are passing as Indians. And but they're getting all the benefits. And they're not paying any taxes, getting free college education. They put up a little reservation on the land that they don't live on. They have another home off and get all kind of benefits.
Iron Eyes Cody was another famous Native American person. He was in the media for years. In the 1970s, they utilized him for this pollution commercial. He was known as the Crying Indian. So he was a very well-known Native American in American culture. But the reality is, Iron Eyes Cody wasn't Native American at all. He was Sicilian. Both of his parents were from Sicily. So he didn't have one drop of Native American blood in him. He was another fake Indian. first authorized paintings from the Americas was of these three African men who were the leaders of a maroon colony down in Central America. And these men, the legend is that they were enslaved Africans who escaped and they were shipwrecked and they formed a maroon colony down in Central America and they became leaders of the Native American tribes down in Central America. And this painting of these three African men, it's at a museum in Madrid, Spain today.
Boukman, Haitian Revolution, the original revolutionary, because he was turned in the night of the revolution. That's when Toussaint Louverture took over. The book Irritated Genie, we need to read. His name was Boukman. Boukman was called Boukman from Jamaica because he couldn't be handling Jamaica. He was sold to Haiti. He started a rebellion amongst the African people. And they knew him as Boukman because they always read. He was very intelligent. He always taught the people who they were and what they were. The night before the revolution, Boukman looked to his brothers and sisters in the field. And he said, you want to win? Cast aside your white god. Embrace your African spirit. You are free. He didn't say you will be free. He didn't say you can be free. He didn't say you could be free. He said, cast aside your white god. You are free.
Had it not been for the Haitian Revolution, America would be 50% of its current size, if not more. The Louisiana Purchase doubled America's size, and it would have never been a Louisiana Purchase if there had never been a Boukman Dada, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Toussaint Louverture, because it was their victory over Napoleon's army that bankrupted the banks of France and forced them to sell its shares of land in America to this country.
Toussaint Louverture gave millions of dollars to a man named Stephen Girard. He was a European sea captain. And Toussaint Louverture gave him this money to get arms because they were going to set up a colony in Africa to fight slavery. And when Toussaint Louverture went to prison, Stephen Girard would not return the money to Toussaint Louverture and his descendants and his family. So Stephen Girard took the money, the millions of dollars that he got from Toussaint Louverture, came to America, started Girard College, and he really became the first American millionaire. And so a lot of people don't know that Girard College was founded on stolen money from Toussaint Louverture. Down in Peru, they found a mummified body of a Peruvian girl who was sacrificed about 500 years ago. And the Peruvian girl, if you look at her, her body's well preserved. She has African features, African facial features. She even has African style braids. And this Peruvian mummified girl is still on display. The HMS Challenger was a ship that went on an expedition in the 1870s. And they went to different places around the world, and one of the places they went to was a place down in South America called Terra de Fuego. It's right on the tip of South America. And they took photographs of some of the Native American people there. And one of the Native Americans down there, one of the Native American pictures they took is a man who looks like a West African man. He's pure Native American, though. And this picture of this Native American man who looks like a West African, this photograph is at the London Museum to this day. So this just goes to show many African-looking people were already over here.
Remember, when they attacked Africa, they did not attack Africa physically. They did not attack Africa educationally. They attacked Africa spiritually. Jomo Kenyatta said when the European first came to Africa, the Africans had the land and the white man had the Bible. White man told him, close his eyes, get on his knees and pray. Jomo said when the black man opened his eyes, the white man had the land and the black man had the Bible. We have bought into a story that we told them. They have twisted it. They got it twisted. We have now bought that story back.
What we call the African and the communities that that person lived in is where the concept of religion comes from. Europe never produced a religion, ever.
Asia receives its religion from Africa. All of them. Buddhism, Hinduism, Shinto. As a matter of fact, to be more scholarly, starts with Hinduism. The first Hindu gods to come across were black Africans. And they came across, they were called Sambo, which is now a derogatory term used for blacks, mulattoes, etc. Sambo.
I said Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are merely fragments from the periphery of the African spiritual system that you call voodoo. People said, you can't even go there with that. I can go there with that. And I can take on any theologian that you got, bring them down, and I'll show you. Give me your 12 tribes. Give me your 12 disciples. Give me your 99 pearls of faith of Islam, and I'll show you those are nothing but sets of qualities and attributes, and I can juxtapose them in a perpendicular line besides the Orishas of the Yoruba, besides the Loas of the Voodoo, besides the Netis of Egypt, and show you we're talking about the same system.
Jesus is a name which did not come into existence in the English form until the 1600s. The letter J was not invented until the 1600s. Let me say this again. Now, the letter J was not invented until the 1600s. So the reality is Jesus is not the name of that person. His name is an Amharic name, Yeshua.
1482, Leonardo da Vinci was commissioned to paint a painting of Christ and the 12 disciples. This was 1482, 10 years before Columbus set sail, because that painting would be the greatest weapon used in colonialism and still is right now, because many black people around the world still have that original Last Supper. And so when Leonardo was asked to paint that picture, he got his uncle to actually sit in, and this is an historic record. He got his uncle to sit in and pose as Christ, and he got 12 criminals from a local jail who happened to be available to sit in as the 12 disciples.
The only reason you call God by that name is because your former enslaver, your former oppressor, taught you that name. He never taught you the real name. He never gave you the keys to the power to free yourself spiritually, so that you are now spiritually or religiously still a slave.
The African population in North America is the third largest black population in the world in any geopolitical state. Why don't we have a single word out of one of our language for God that we use? The Arabs use their word for God. The Jews use their word for God. The Catholics use their word for God. The Japanese use their word for God. The African is the only population that don't have an African word for God. Yet, studies coming out of Geneva over the last 30 years prove that we are the most spiritual people in America, in the world, not just America. We worship with a greater propensity than any other people in the world, but we don't have a single word in our language for our divine.
The word Christ is a title. It's not a name. Christ means the anointed one. And there were many people before the birth of Jesus who also bore that title, Christ. There were 16 people who were known as Christ. So Jesus was the last of saviors of mankind, saviors of a group of people who were known as Christ.
When you talk about the image of Christ, it is important that we no longer ascribe to the European image of Christ. Why? Because the brain is an associating organism. It stores everything as pictures. And because it is associating, if you force feed an African child that Christ is white, because the brain associates, as that child begins to grow, the brain will associate white Christ with white people.
And so if white Jesus is God, then white people must also be the gods of humanity. And so guess what? The power in the painting is transferred to the people who resemble that painting. And so it is difficult to pray to a white Jesus and not in some way feel inferior to white people. And that's why when I talk to Christian ministers, I often tell them, you have to change these pictures. They say it don't matter. Of course it matters. Why do you think the European went around the world and systematically altered the image of Christ in every major cathedral, every major church, every corner of the globe? Because it is difficult to oppress a people whose image of the God doesn't look like the oppressor. But when God and the oppressor look one in the same, then the people will come to believe that the oppression was ordained by God.
What we find is that in this story that came out of Kemet, after Aset reconstituted the body of her husband Asar, the spirit of Asar came and impregnated his virgin wife, Aset. And then 9 months later, the virgin Aset gave birth to her son, Heru. And Heru was born 4,000 years ago on December the 25th.
So in 325, it was decided that Jesus Christ would be a son of God. In 325, it was decided that Jesus Christ...